You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson. This is the Orthodox Nationalist. This is the 16th of November, 2025. And I have been talking about this big, you know, announcement, this big thing we have. Some of you probably know already that Sven Longshanks, a man who suffered under the leftist regime in Britain, is out, not just out of prison, but out of probation and everything that goes along with it. And he's come out of it, from everything that I could hear so far, much better than he went into it. He used it rather than just stew in his anger and irritation, as I probably would have done. He used it as a time to better himself in every possible way. So on Sunday, which technically is today, will be our first roundtable, Grandpa, Sven, and myself. And I suppose we'll be spending most of our time talking about what it was like. So he's somebody that now deserves respect more than ever, and Radio Albion deserves support more than ever. Beyond that, my book on the Ukraine war will probably be out this week. It's finished. I don't want to look at it anymore. I don't want to deal with it anymore. You know, text-wise, everything's been done. If they're mistakes, then they're mistakes. I get to this point, that's where all my books get published, when I'm sick of it. That's the only way I end up publishing anything. So, I will give you all the details on that when that actually happens. Today, though, we're going to be talking about an old topic that we've dealt with many times, a topic that comes up quite a bit, at least in my world. But every time I find a new source, especially an old one, one that no one's really ever heard of before, I say, oh, no, this I have to tell everyone about. And that's what I'm doing here. I don't know how many hours I spent on the Cossacks since I started this Voice of Reason, all the way to Radio Albion from 2008 to now. But I came across a book by a Cossack emigre named Vladimir Sinilkov, published in 1928. It's called The Cossacks and Their National Significance. There is no way this thing is in English, but I translated parts of it. There's much I disagree with, but much I very much agree with. And that's what makes it interesting. So, he makes the argument, to start off with, talk about the origins of what a Cossack is. That's identical with the origin of Russia herself. Now, he also claims, and I don't know about this, the Cossack idea is not unique to Russia. The steppe is extremely distinctive in the geographic condition, the size, the absence of established borders in the south throughout history, really right until the 20th century in these outlying areas. The struggle against nomads contributed to the development of this idea on a huge and significant scale. in Russia, but he claims it existed elsewhere too. I mean, to me, a Cossack is a warrior in a specific tradition who's either an old believer or a true Orthodox man, usually a royalist. Lots of old believers down there. The horseman stuff, well, that comes with it, of course, whose job it is to rescue Christians from Jewish slavery, which is what they're, you know, and sometimes they say Turkish slavery, but we all know what they really mean. But here's what he says. Even in the first centuries of the Byzantine Empire, a Cossack sect existed on the eastern borders of that state. Military settlements of hunters were established along the border strip in Asia Minor. They were assigned land, which they were required to cultivate without paying taxes, and in return, repel the raids of nomads moving westward. A similar Cossack community in Hungary along the southeastern border, consisting of Slavs, resettled there during a long and bitter struggle with the Turks. The end of the raids and the consolidation of the borders, the Cossack settled peacefully. Now, this edition, it was reprinted by the Russian Idea Publishing House in 2004. There's a lot to disagree with here. It's not just any, you know, semi-regular force. In no way were the Cossacks ever granted land in exchange for service. That was a service nobility under the Muscovite state. They certainly repelled raids of nomads. But to be Cossack is to be Orthodox, specifically a Slavic Orthodox. No such thing as Jewish or anything, any other kind of Cossack. So he broadens the idea to refer to any, I guess in the West you would call marcher lords, anyone who was sent to tame untamable areas. And it's just not true. He even goes so far as to say that those fleeing, you know, the Dutch Protestants landing in America were the same because they acted as freebooters. They escaped Anglican British rule and they went across the ocean. Hence, they might even be Cossack in a sense. And that's, you know, come on. That's a, he's stretching the definition to the point where it doesn't mean anything anymore. But regardless of that, it's precisely that the nature of the steppe, the plain, goes across all of Eurasia, the size of it. That was decisive in the settlement of Eastern Slavs. They eventually formed a single state. Western Europe had way too many mountains. The Alps alone. You know, the service of the Alps is divided between, or I should say among, five modern states. Italy, France, Switzerland, you know, Bavaria, Austria. And their valleys. In the Middle Ages, of course. Even more than that. More importantly, the Cossacks also realized that where they first developed, there's two sides to this. There's a Ukrainian side, and then there's a Russian side. Two very different groups. They were both Cossacks, without doubt. I've spent a lot of time talking about the Ukrainian side, the Hetman state, Zaporozhye, the Sikh, and everything that goes along with it. But talking about Kuban and Terek and Ural Cossack hosts, that's from a Russian point of view. There are, I mean, I guess officially listed maybe 10 or 12 Russian Cossack hosts, even near the Bug River, going all the way to the Far East. You know, when a Cossack host is established by the state, it almost by definition isn't a Cossack host at all. However, in both the Ukrainian and the Russian side, they ensconced themselves in a very, very, in an area very conducive for mercantile wealth. To the east, through the Caucasus to Turkestan, number one. Number two, to the south along the Dnieper and the Black Sea. And three, to the west along the Danube, connected with the three contemporary centers of development, Central Asia, Byzantium, and the southern coast of Western Europe. Western Ukraine, although very Russian, very Orthodox, became wealthy and independent because of this. In their case, the salt trade. The Slavs, however, continued to suffer from attacks. The steppe, given its size, given that there's nowhere to hide, attacks from nomads were a constant threat. Even from the north, there are Lithuanian and Finnish forces in the early Middle Ages. But from the south, from the Turkish groups, or Turkic groups, I should say, trade became a problem. Individual cities were then forced to arm themselves and assume the protection of the waterway from north to south. Now, I don't want to get into the Normanist thesis of Russian development, nor is it all that relevant here, and I'm not sure why the writer brings it up, since it really has nothing to do with the topic. But for more than three centuries, the struggle was waged with the steppe. The Khazars, the 9th and 10th centuries. Now the Pechenegs, they're the Turkic mounted warriors, who also fought the Khazars in the 10th and 11th centuries. Then the Kumans or the Kipchaks. Kipchak means white and blonde. However, they were known as fierce warriors in the 11th and 12th centuries, right up until the invasion of the so-called Mongols. Now, he claims that at that time, the Cossacks, as we're accustomed to understanding them, didn't exist. And that's probably, I'm willing to say he's correct. At first, the Cossacks didn't have names. There was no talk of their armies. They had to fight in separate groups. They even had few horses, downriver and boats. Southern Cossacks, the Anatolian and Persian shores by water much later, 11th and 12th centuries. Northern Cossacks, well, they weren't really Cossacks, but already reached the Urals, shores of the White Sea. But the claim is that all of these groups existed to get away from the central state. Some of that might be true, although being a member of a Cossack host had tremendous responsibilities. It was a knightly caste, but at this period of time, there was no conception of that, not quite yet. Yeah, you may have had individual groups moving from place to place in unsettled areas, which there were a lot in Russia, but there were no infidels, and the state quickly reached its natural borders and consolidated them. So let me quote him directly to clear this up. When did the Cossacks, taking the form we know today, emerge? Well, they never ceased to exist from the very birth of Rus, but existed on a small, unnoticed scale, unremarked even by our own history. It couldn't have been otherwise. While Rus was gathering together, while the Tartar yoke weighed heavily upon us, there was a centripetal trend in migration, as life was safer under Moscow's protection, and these men of honor, who later called themselves Cossacks, could not venture far into the steppe. Men of honor is the best I could do for that phrase. Now, the point he's trying to make is that after that yoke was removed, I don't believe it was a foreign yoke at all, but it still was a yoke, Moscow then began to centralize. It expanded to the south and the east. That means these same forces moved further and further into the steppes. Sorry, farther and farther into the steppes. But they never severed ties with the state. What he's saying in here is that certain groups of the service nobles were indistinguishable from Cossacks. Now, that's a pretty controversial thing to say. Normally, in Russian textbooks, they'll say a Cossack is a group of people who have run away from their responsibilities on the farm or something like that, or they have a lot of debt. You know, they owe too many people. They have nothing to live for. Or they just don't like to be told what to do. But increasingly, groups settled far beyond the state's border, beyond the reach of its authority. Now the beginning of the Cossack mind began. These small groups took on the name Kurin, the term that came to mean these very small bands. However, they realized that they were valuable. Because of these nomads, the need for protection forced them to unite into stanitsas, or basic villages, and then into communities, which is basically hosts, the largest of the Cossack forces. He then says that the struggle proves far too much for them, and they had to rely on the state. Well, at least on the Ukrainian side, they did everything they could to avoid the state. They used the state now and again. It could be Poland, it could be Sweden, it could be Turkey, it could be... But that was the point. Never to come under one power. However, because this was specifically an Orthodox group, and the centralized Muscovite state was able to build a tremendously resourceful set of institutions, now the fight against the nomads became a national concern. They became a huge part in the life of the state. So maybe there is something to say that certain service nobles and Cossacks, that line is blurry, especially as very close to the border. But as Russia developed, he says, all these different hopes emerged. You know, they shifted, they moved from place to place. He even calls it wandering Rus, paving the way for settled Rus. Well, you know, it's wandering for a very specific reason. Now, in Ukraine, you did have a settled Cossack Hetmanate, which in itself had its own set of problems. In the first centuries of the Cossacks' existence, in the sense we know them, the state exploited them. But when it was advantageous in diplomatic relations, for example, it abandoned them, leaving them to their own devices. So if the Tsar has made peace with the Turks, you can't raid Turkish camps anymore, regardless of anything else. Usually they said, no, we're going to keep doing it. So then the Sultan would contact the Tsar and said, well, you have to control these people. As a result, tremendous divisions occurred. In 1684, the great Hetman Sadochny invited the Don Cossacks to join him in Crimea. They refused. There was a rabble, so to speak, that followed him. Moscow wrote to the Don the following year, for you Cossacks, without our decree, to enter into an alliance with the Polish king or to assist him with a campaign to the Sea of Azov is not only unthinkable, because we are now at peace with the Turkish Sultan and the Crimean Khan. Same thing goes after 1686 when peace with Poland was concluded. Well, that's their whole thing. Either fighting Catholic Poles, Uniates, and specifically, you know, the Jewish connection between that ruled the Polish economy, and the Turks. That was their whole thing. It took a long time for the Russian state to sort of settle them. Oh, by the way, I had a debate with someone the other day. Actually, it may have been today. I have no idea what the days are anymore. And he was telling me about that the Ukrainian Cossacks are fighting Russians in this war. And I just stared at him. I knew. Did you ever have one of those things where so many responses come into your head that you can't pick one? I said, let me explain it to you. There is no way in hell any historical Cossack group is fighting for this Jew. He's shutting down churches. He's banning the Russian language. If you could point to anybody, he's being paid a huge amount of money to do it. And actually, there's historical precedent for that. But they are not gladly fighting for this Jew in Kiev. There's a lot more Cossacks out there than you realize, but over the last 100 years, they have become entirely pro-Russian, and they've been fighting in the Donetsk and Luhansk militias up until, of course, it became a part of Russia. Initially, all Cossack armies resembled the Zaporozhian Sikh in some way. They were purely military units. Zaporozhian means beyond the rapids. They were on a group of islands that was almost impossible for anyone else to get to. That's where their fortress was. They were religious socialists. Everything was, you know, I mean, they had ranks and everything, but everything was basically equal. They were all brothers. If they were married, their wives lived somewhere else. That was the authority, not necessarily the power, but the authority for Cossacks everywhere. I think that's what he's trying to say here, and he's right. This is why Catherine the Great destroyed it at great expense. By destroying the Sikh, they destroyed very much, you know, the Cossack center. They always, you know, once a certain hetmanate somewhere got too settled, took too many favors from Moscow or Poland or whoever, once they did that, the Sikh would be the first to point it out. They were the conscience of other bands, other hosts. Now, despite their freedom, there was one thing that was totally non-negotiable. Actually, it was because of their freedom. What am I saying? He says despite their freedom, I'm pretty sure. They were the strictest of Orthodox people. For the most part, the old believers found a home there, especially in the Terek, which is the farthest south. But they're dealing with constant wars and raids. So recruitment came from where? It came from people fleeing from other parts of Russia, especially poor people, didn't have families or didn't care. If it was not a monastic order, but they acted like it while they were in the circle. It was at a point where, until the very end of the 17th century, plowing the land was prohibited. It was punishable by the death penalty. Why? Because we are not to be settled. The Rechabites in the Old Testament, in the book of the prophecy of Jeremiah. Rechabites, however you say it. One of my favorite groups. That's who we are, that Jeremiah loved. The minute we get settled, we're gonna start dividing ourselves into classes, taking favors from governments. Before you know it, we're going to be an arm or a leg of a government. The total opposite of we're not going to be used by somebody. There was a sense of statehood, though, especially in the face of constant danger. The hetman, who was elected by the warrior circle, the main warriors, while in warfare, on campaign, he had the power of life and death over the Cossacks. The Krug, or the circle, that also was a judicial body. But, you know, on occasion, if there was serious disagreement, they would appeal to another power, you know, Moscow, even Constantinople. Now, the author I'm dealing with here says that the Cossack armies did not represent separate entities, nor even clearly defined units, until the state authorities brought them into being. Now, I had to think about that for a while, because I'm thinking there's a positive and there's a negative to that. They existed precisely in contrast to the state. They weren't even opposed to it. They just represented a different aspect of Orthodox life. In pre-Petrine Russia or Muscovite Russia, there was a deliberate informality. They were able to move from place to place. The Dnieper to the Urals. Their form was not established, however, by the state. Although, you know, the hetman in Ukraine may very well have been as a result of their reaction to the state power, the Polish state power. Now, I think I've mentioned this either in a paper before, but the author says that these groups did not have the foundations of a state. And he has seven reasons. It sounds familiar that I may have said this before, but I don't think so. They didn't live in a defined territory. Well, in the Middle Ages, that was the case everywhere. Borders were always very fluid. I'm not sure that that's necessarily, you know, a modern state. You know, if he said he didn't have the foundations of a modern state, that would be one thing, but he doesn't. There was no defined population. They didn't perform a census, I guess is what he means there. There was no citizenship. Now, I have to vehemently disagree. There was a concept of membership. Very different from citizenship. There was no civil law. That's simply not true. And he should know better. No definite duties in relation to the state. That sounds circular. I don't know if he means the state that doesn't exist amongst the Cossacks or to Russia or whoever they're, you know, connected to. I guess they didn't have the concept of definite duties in relation to the state. As far as their own organization was, they most certainly did. It wasn't formalized, but that's exactly what made them so powerful. Number five, no taxes, meaning no regular taxes. To a great extent, they weren't monetized. So taxes could mean a whole bunch of different things. Number six is an odd one. Because the Cossack groups didn't have the foundation of a state because they have no government institutions. What it says there, if they didn't have a foundation for a state because they didn't have a state. I don't think, maybe my translation is off. That may be it. And no treasury. Treasury to him is a sign of statehood. I don't even know if that's true. This certainly was not a modern state. It was a medieval order of knights. So I'm not sure what the question of whether it has the foundation of a state even matters. They saw themselves that way. To this day, they see themselves that way. By the time, like, the Don Host was totally settled, 1791, very late in the Cossacks' development. Cousin to the Don Host was first recorded. A charter, 1793, assigned land to it. 1795, boundaries with neighboring regions were delineated. Is it a state then? This is only after, you know, their central institutions have been crushed. But there is a very big difference between Cossacks on Russian territory and Cossacks on Ukrainian territory. Maybe the Sikh itself and the Hetmanate versus all the others. You know, the Don, the Kuban, Ural in Russia itself. Tsar Fyodor, who died in 1598, he issued charters ordering the Cossacks to escort his ambassadors from Rzinsk to Azov, and as well as Turkish ambassadors. Now, as in payment, the Cossacks received salt, lead, cloth, supplies, many other things. Small detachments were sent to Moscow several times a year to report on the situation on the border. Sometimes the Cossacks got paid, sometimes it went the other direction. Mikhail Fyodorovich instructed in his charters, he said, the Tsar himself, do not go to sea to plunder, and thereby do not cause us to quarrel with the Turkish Sultan. If you obey, you will be serving us directly. If, beyond all expectation, you will cause harm to our relations with the Turks after this, we will place you in disgrace. Never summon you to Moscow for favor. Send an army against you. Order a fortress to be erected in the place of your discord and drive you from the Don. Upon saying that, he granted the Don the authority of the Hetman of the Don, the, you know, the feather, the bunchuk, or the regimental banner. The bunchuk is the, I have a replica of one here. The mace. On the left bank of the Dnieper, the Cossacks found they had no choice but to get closer to Moscow. But even, as I've said many times before, even some of the most pro-Russian hetman eventually broke with Moscow. They took too much. We haven't gotten to Peter yet. This is why the Zaporozhian Sikh was so important. Because it was pointing these things out. You're just another state now. You're just another government now. That's not what your job is. The author we're dealing with here states this. It's hard to tell what era he's talking about, but from the Cossacks' relations with Moscow, it is clear that neither Moscow nor the Cossacks themselves considered themselves an independent state entity. Peter the Great's actions could not help but impact the Cossack way of life, since it touched all corners of Russian life. The state expanded and almost reached its southern borders, in other words, its terminus. It had already reached the Prut, Azov, and Derbent rivers, thus encompassing Cossack lands, which, by becoming part of the state, found themselves now immersed in the vortex of national life. From that time on, ties began to give way to fusion. Now again, this is from an entirely Russian point of view. Remember, he is a white emigre of Cossack background, no doubt with severe PTSD, writing this few years after he landed, wherever he went to in the U.S. I think it was Paris. He refuses to talk about Peter's destruction and humiliation and exploitation of the Cossacks. Now, it's simply bad history. The only reason Mazeppa had to abandon Peter was for this reason. He was using, Cossack infantry were and horsemen were the best. I shouldn't say infantry. Cossack horsemen were the best in the region. He was using them to the point where there was nothing left. At places that had no bearing on Cossack interest. So from 1700 to 1718, it was Peter who was approving the elections of their hetman. They may pretend to elect a hetman, but only if Peter agreed. Since 1827, the heir to the throne automatically became the admin of all Cossack hosts, all over the place. There is a sense where this emphasized the enormous national significance of the Cossacks. This integration may legitimately be inevitable given the size and the power of the Moscow state. But it also says, State Statute 1835 prescribed unceasing vigilance to ensure that the privileges and advantages granted to the Cossacks are not violated or weakened. Unfortunately, that was done all the time. The Ottomans or Hetmans were equated with governor generals, I don't know. And the hosts were provincial institutions. They were legalized they were institutionalized. There were allotted land, which is something they were trying to avoid for a long time. In the Don region, they were allotted 8 to 11 desiatines. Each desiatine is about 2.7 acres. And afterwards, 30. That's per Cossack. That was extended to Kuban and other areas. It took until the 1870s for the subordination of the Cossacks entirely to the center in matters of judicial and police administration. The argument he makes sometimes it's hard to resist. The Cossack lands that became part of the state, meaning the Moscow state. Well, actually, here he's talking about the Petersburg state, too. And the Don host even preceded that of the Stavropol governorate. Could not help but submit to the general, lawful course of internal organization. The Don host, the first to join the royal state, even witnessed the beginnings of serfdom and the stratification of Cossacks into estates. But given the lack of time, it didn't develop. Other places, upper classes were just beginning to emerge. And it certainly emerged in the Hetmanate state in Ukraine. So let's talk about these regional identities. The Zaporozhian host, of course, is the first one. They defended and preserved Russia and Orthodoxy and Western Rus from the 14th to the 18th centuries. In other words, from the annexation of the Russo-Lithuanian lands to Poland. And it was brutal, and it was stubborn. Poland was trying to Polonize and Catholicize Western Rus entirely, using the Union or whatever they needed to. They had to wage a war on two fronts, without outside support, really. Their campaign in the Polish army against Moscow during the time of troubles, well, that wasn't a Cossack campaign, but they were involved in it. After all, they were already a part of the Polish army, called upon to assist the Muscovite nobility who wanted to install Prince Vladislav in Moscow. I know it's insane. That's what happened. This is what happens when you get too involved. They signed contracts. This is what they were all about, apparently. They had made many deals with Turks, Poles, whomever, over the years. In this case, many of them were part of the Polish army. So you had the seditious oligarchs, after the death of Ivan the Terrible, wanted to restore their advantages. Of course, I've talked about that since I was 25 years old. The new landed nobility, the service people, and the taxpaying population, who were already starting to look at the possible fetters of serfdom in the future. That's what makes it kind of make sense. When Moscow wanted to crush the Cossacks, maybe going to Poland wasn't such a bad idea so long as they remained Orthodox. Remember, we talked about this the last time. Poland had agreed to remove the Union, remove the Jews, which was a huge demand, from their lands. I don't know, maybe this isn't so bad. It was naive. But eventually, after all this, they moved to beyond the rapids, specifically the largest of the islands, Kortysia. Kortysia Island, which has a large museum of the Cossack organization there today. So technically it was founded in 1550. And you had people flooding there. Orthodox people from Lithuania who were being kicked out. People didn't want to pay taxes. People, I told you, the people in debt, they didn't want to be serfs anymore, whatever the issue was. The only reason that Orthodoxy exists at all in Ukraine and even Belarus is the actions, the violent actions of the Cossack host, specifically that from Zaporozhye. Plus, they had to serve as an outpost against Tartar and Turkish raids. The minute the Jewish middleman was introduced and received power, that's all of a sudden when serfdom got bad. That's all of a sudden when you have this flood of people, Orthodox people, running to the Cossacks. Because these Jewish middlemen, I mean, we've been through this so many times, has taken fishing and hunting rights, roads and taverns, but Orthodox churches as well. The church didn't own its own churches. That comes from the French representative to the court of Catherine II in his Chronicles of Little Rus, published in Paris in 1786. So you have foreigners saying this. This isn't just me saying this. This is where Khmelnytsky came from. The Unia was created in 1596. It was in 1625. Metropolitan of Kiev issued an appeal to the Cossacks, asking them to defend the Orthodox Church and its pastors. And that marked the beginning of the war between the Cossacks, Ukrainian and Russian, against the Poles. However, this was 1637, not 1648. What they did to the Cossacks, who revolted and failed, they were broken on the wheel. were broken, long nails, dismemberment, stakes, whatever. And of course, churches were desecrated in the worst way possible. Vessels were sold to Jews. So when the Cossacks got a little bit angry under Khmelnytsky, well, this is why. Khmelnytsky rose up 11 years after that, the Khmelnytsky uprising. All of Ukraine, and really all of Orthodoxy, rose up with him. The Ecumenical Patriarch in Constantinople sent him a sword as a sign that Khmelnytsky had undertaken the defense of the Greek faith, the Greek Orthodox faith. Now, Khmelnytsky had captured most of Ukraine. However, Poland was better organized. Even though it was an oligarchic state, it was a state. The Cossack organization, because of how it was, couldn't hold out for long. Cossacks aren't built for wars of attrition. So they went to Moscow. They had considered Sweden. There were all these discussions, but Moscow's diplomats did hesitate. They didn't want a new war with Poland. And that was the start of the ruin on the right bank of the Ukraine. But many of the Cossacks were forced to cross over into Moscow's land, that is to say, the left bank of Ukraine, left bank of the Dnieper. Well, I think you're getting my point here. The Cossack raiders had many weaknesses. They could not handle a war of attrition. They were raiders. That's what they were. They were Russian Orthodox bikers, essentially, is what they were. Very strict. But that's, you know, in today's world, that's what they would be. In 1775, Petersburg shut the Zaporozhian Sikh down. Now, the decree that did this, the Catherine, here's a piece of it. It says, "We will not mention here the complaints brought to our throne by neighboring states about the raids and plunder that the Zaporozhian Cossacks constantly commit along the border, or the violence they commit against their compatriots, our subjects." I guess that was a big worry. Then after it was abolished, 5,000 Cossacks fled to Turkey. And they were resettled in the Kuban region. Most of them were old believers. Now, the Don Host is a different story. It's hard to tell. I mean, there's a few mentions of them, that the Don forces in the Battle of Kulikovo in 1380. But not as Cossacks, of course. As Cossacks is mentioned in 1551, when the Turkish Sultan complained to Tsar Ivan the Terrible about their attacks on Crimea. Some of the place names suggest that a lot of the transplants were from places like Novgorod and Pskov, kind of created their own small towns named after those other places. But they fled from, you know, the serfs, stewards from their employers, from debts, warriors from service, dissenters from persecution. And of course, there was no extradition from the Don. First settlers had a tough time. Back then, they were called the Trakasi group. But that was the core of the initial Don army. But it grew very rapidly. 1708, the male Cossack population was about 28,000, 29,000. 1785, 70,000. Kuban, a bit more complex. It lasted only about 80 years. and it goes back to a regular force. The Kopersky Regiment took part in the capture of Azov in 1696. They didn't like how they were treated. 1775, they left. 200 families settled along the line below Tsaritsyn. That was actually fortified by Potemkin in 1777, 1778. Beyond that, after the Sikh was destroyed, Potemkin gathered all the remaining Cossacks and formed a core of new ones, loyal ones, and brought them to that area, brought them to the Kuban. But 20,000 people were being resettled there a year near the Black Sea. They had about 60 outposts, 100 pickets in between the outposts. This was a big, even bigger than most of the others, big old believer center. They took high casualties, but they were replenished very, very quickly and very easily. The original core of Cossacks, the way we understand the term, was not created out of anything. But in the Russian side, they were. Sometimes without state approval, of course. Dissident Cossacks went to the Kuban. They had many splits among them, actually. Mozduk Fortress was founded. 350 Don families were settled along that line, along that defensive line. Then 5,000 Volga Cossacks were settled along the defensive line for much of the southern area. Volga, you know, the Volga Cossacks had control over potentially a very wealthy area. Now, you get to the Urals, the Ural Cossacks, Ural Mountain Cossacks. Sometimes you call them a Yaik. Y-A-I-K, sometimes, early 16th century. After the suppression of the Volga Freemen in 1577, that was one route to get out. The Central Asian Turkic groups, they were sent to the against the Tartar Shumkal in the North Caucasus, against Kiva in 1605. The remnants of the Golden Horde early on, Kyrgyz. But once the Tartars destroyed it, they had no choice but to go to, in this case, Tsar Mikhail, for assistance. Then they began to be receiving regular wages and weapons, gunpowder. Tsar Peter had a census of, there were 3,200 there. By the end of the 19th century, you had about 15,000 total. Now, when the Ryazan lands were annexed by Moscow, some Cossacks migrated down the Volga and settled in its lower reaches. And they were joined by many refugees after the capture of Astrakhan. This became the Astrakhan Cossack host. That also, it had the same development. The line between the Volga and the Don was fortified. You have plenty of Ukrainian Cossack station there. But you didn't have any formal host there until 1750. After the suppression of the Pugachev Rebellion, the Volga host consisting of Don and Ukrainian Cossacks, stationed from Saratov to Zaritsyn, was completely abolished. Then, of course, the Trans-Urals. Is a separate one altogether. They were formed, at least in part, by the expedition of Yermak, financed by the Stroganovs, to map out and to bring Siberia under Russian control. The Cossacks were used for that. This is how they came into existence. They eventually reached the Arctic Ocean. In 1648, they fortified towns. It was a Cossack, Dezhnev, reached the easternmost parts of Siberia. Vysotsny Mis, actually, almost essentially before Bering did. They built the entire array of towns. Yatsuk reached the Amur and Ussuri rivers. The Cossack Baikal reached the Gobi Desert in 1654. Chinese border in 1666. So in less than a century, the Cossacks annexed all of Siberia. A place larger than the U.S., and then a century later, they reached Alaska, in the western shores of North America. Now, you had people, you had Kyrgyz people, you had Kalmyks, but these are different ethnic groups, but they all were Orthodox. There was no question about it. They built town after town after town. The monarchy, sending people to it with, they don't have to pay taxes. They get everything for free. But the Siberian Cossacks really, until the 19th century, didn't constitute an army in and of itself. Obviously, they had a huge place to cover. The Siberian host was formed in 1808. And the small one, the Orenburg, when you think of Cossacks, you don't think of Orenburg. But they ceased to exist in 1920. And again, this was how the state was transferring groups of Cossacks from place to place. In 1855, the cavalry regiment, the Transbaikalians, was formed. Again, these were all in the process of forming defensive lines very far away from Moscow. Very hard to defend. There's only one group of people who can do it. And they tried to, 1861-62, some settlers were assigned to it. That's a tough, they were assigned to it. It doesn't mean they're going to stay there. There was no way to enforce that. But when settlers are assigned to it, again, everything was free. This is an incredibly beautiful place, by the way, physically. Very mixed, ethnically, but Orthodox, 100%. Some of these groups, Transbaikalians, and the Nechinsk regions, on and on. These became the Bashkirs, Kyrgyz, even though they initially started off as enemies. They end up becoming extremely loyal to and fought for the White Army, as did all the Cossacks. So what happened? I've never talked about Lenin's, the resolution that was passed January 24th, 1919, which has come down to us as de-Kulakization. I'm sorry, de-Cossackization. They're actually related. Now, the actual translation is Lenin ordered the local branches of the party to, quote, carry out mass terror against wealthy Cossacks, exterminating all of them. Carry out merciless mass terror against any and all Cossacks taking part in any way, directly or indirectly, in the struggle against Soviet power. Now, that has to be unpacked here a little bit. Wealthy class, no, they're all relatively equal. That was just something for the party to grab onto. That was ignored entirely. Whether they're wealthy or not was irrelevant. But taking part directly or indirectly, how do you avoid being indirectly involved? All the Cossack hosts were fighting the Soviets. So on February 7th of that year, the Southern Front issued its own instructions on how this is to be applied. And what they say is that the main duty here is to neutralize the Cossack through the merciless extirpation of its elite. District and Stanitsa Atamans are subject to unconditional elimination, but local Atamans should be subject to execution only in those cases where it can be proved they were actually supported Krasnov's policies. Having organized pacification, conducted mobilization, refused to offer refuge to revolutionary Cossacks, order Red Army men, etc. Well, there were no trials. All of this was just verbiage. They were slaughtered. According to the Black Book of Communism, in mid-March of 1919 alone, the Cheka condemned more than 8,000 Cossacks to death. In each region, all the regions we just talked about, summary judgments were passed by revolutionary courts within seconds, and whole lists of people were condemned for counter-revolutionary behavior. I mean, the Don region, we've spoken about these regions many times. With Wrangel's forces, they forced the Red Army out of the area in 1920. Crimea was then retaken by the Red Army, and then the Cossacks were, of course, they wouldn't leave, for the most part. 6,000 people were condemned to death in October 1920 alone. Families, and often the neighbors again, this is according to the Black Book of Communism, of anybody, you know, again, direct or indirect, which is, you know, that would be everybody, taken as hostages. So let me read it exactly from that same book, Black Book of Communism. Gathered together in a camp near Maikop, the hostages, women, children, and old men, survived the most appalling conditions in the cold and the mud of October. They're dying like flies. The women will do anything to escape death. The soldiers guarding the camp take advantage of this and treat them as prostitutes. So in November of 1920, the head of the Cheka, Zhu Dzerzhinsky, said to Lenin, again from the same source, the revolutionary state must organize the internment of Cossacks in camps of about 100,000 prisoners from the Southern Front and vast masses of people expelled from the rebellious Cossack settlement, the Terek, Kuban, and the Don. He knew. Lenin was well aware of what was going on here. Now, there are plenty of even mainline scholars, I was happy to hear, you know, consider this genocide. I never considered Cossacks to be a separate nation. It's conceivable, but I never considered it the case. The Cheka in Pyatigorsk organized the Day of Red Terror. And the job was to get 300 executed per day. And they ordered the party, the local party, to come up with a list. And just like in, you know, North Vietnam, it was whoever you wanted. Cossack towns were burnt to the ground. There were 3-4 million Cossacks in these areas before. How many are there today? Most reliable estimates that between 300,000 and 500,000 were killed. Now that what may include those deported in 1919 and 1920. Out of a population of 3 million, that's roughly the Don and Kuban area. A lot of people say 700,000. Of course, the Cossacks were hated for a whole bunch of reasons, but they were the mainstay of the anti-communist forces. So when the war ended, the Cossacks were slaughtered. I think there are more Cossacks out there than we realize. They're part of the special forces of the Russian army. I know this for a fact. They have all kinds of parades and everything else. It's still a nightly cast. And as I've said a million times before, this group needs to take over the Ukrainian government in a coup, which would be very popular. You don't really even need a lot of people for it. And make peace with the Russians, prisoner swaps, and reorient your country to the east, if it has any chance of survival. Of course, I've said that before, I'll say it again. So the book I've been dealing with, Vladimir Nyokov's The Cossacks and Their National Significance, came out in 1928. He was an emigre or an exile in Paris, I believe. And that was a basic core of his book, but most of this was really what I have to say about it, rather than what he says. I think there's a few errors in there, but I think these errors can be understood given the circumstances. Given where they were and what they were doing, these people were not wealthy. They were living hand to mouth. The Cossacks will never stop being of great interest to Orthodox people, whether Nikonian or Old Believer. They will never not matter to Holy Russia. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.